welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Tuesday, July 28th. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. And our top headline is Lynch to fill open council seat. A man who previously held the position for 12 years, but who has no plans to run for re-election next year, was appointed Monday to a vacant Dubuque City Council seat. Council members voted 4-2 during a special meeting to appoint Kevin Lynch from a pool of 10 applicants to the first ward seat vacated earlier this month by Brett Shaw. The ward covers much of the southern and western half of Dubuque. Lynch, age 61, stepped down from the Ward 1 seat in 2017, choosing not to seek re-election. "I feel that my 12 years of experience would be helpful in these unprecedented times we're living," Lynch wrote council members. Lynch, though, indicated he has no intention of running for re-election when the term ends. He would hold the seat until the November 2, 2021 election, unless residents petitioned to have the seat filled by special election. Council members said the city needs a steady, experienced hand on the wheel as the city responds to the global pandemic and economic recession on top of working to address heightened racial tensions. "The situation we're in today is unprecedented in the history of Dubuque and really the history of the nation," said Councilmember Rick Jones. "And with goal-setting sessions just days away on August 10th through the 12th, and with the enormous volume of information a new council member needs to take in, with respect to the outstanding candidates that applied, Kevin Lynch is the surest thing to hit the ground running." Lynch beat out Magoo's Pizza co-founder Susan Farber after two rounds of voting. Farber received two votes in each round of voting from council members Danny Sprank and Brad Kavanaugh. "I've had the opportunity to serve on the Dubuque initiatives with Susan. I've already found myself not in agreement with Susan at every turn," Kavanaugh said. "And we have some great discussions on that board, and there's a back and forth. And I appreciate Susan's take on a lot of the issues that come before us. I think she would do the same here on the council." After a career working as an executive for global telecommunications corporations, including AT&T and Verizon, Farber returned to Dubuque in 2003. She rehabbed vintage brownstones in Cable Car Square and founded Magoo's Pizza with her husband. She told council members during a prior special meeting to interview candidates for the seat that her priority as a council member will be continuing to build a robust local economy with a focus on improving diversity and equity, historic preservation, and quality, livable neighborhoods that are safe and healthy. Councilmember David Resnick, who first voted for mental health consultant and local volunteer Amy Crow Sunleaf to aid with the council's priority to address brain health, ended up voting for Lynch. Councilmember Laura Russell and Mayor Roy Buell also backed Lynch. Russell said Lynch provides First Ward residents an experienced representative that they know and would allow them to express their opinion again then in the next regular election after they've had time to be introduced more thoroughly to all of the applicants in the next campaign. Buell echoed those comments. All council members praised the strong field of candidates. Lynch, during the special meeting to interview candidates for the seat, touted his work serving on the boards of various economic development organizations, including currently as chairman of Dubuque Initiatives. He also highlighted his work with city officials while on the city council to help build a local network of nonprofit, religious, school, business, labor, and government leaders dedicated to advancing justice and social equity in Dubuque. "It's a very positive thing to have 10 very qualified candidates to fill this position, and it speaks very well to the future of leadership in Dubuque," Lynch told council members. "However, there's only one person that can come in and do the job from day one, and has done it before and knows how to do with that with very little learning curve whatsoever, and that's me." First Ward resident Rick Trosh previously told this Telegraph Herald he is part of a splinter group of grassroots conservatives who are behind the now-defunct Dubuque PAC Political Action Committee. He said the group is backing one of the candidates for the seat but would not disclose whom. "If their candidate is not appointed," he said, "the group planned to move ahead with a petition for a special election. Such a petition would need at least 157 signatures from ward residents and must be filled within 14 days of the appointment being made. Must be filed within 14 days of the appointment being made." Trosh could not be reached for comment on Monday. Dubuque bar owner critically ill with COVID. The owner of a popular Dubuque bar is critically ill after contracting COVID-19. Larry Economopoulos, the 51-year-old owner of Skinny McGinnies at 345 Main Street, was airlifted Sunday to UW Health University Hospital in Madison, according to his friend Jeff Robb. "The doctors and nurses at UW Madison are doing everything they can for him," Robb said. Economopoulos was tested for COVID-19 on June 29th after he came down ill. He reported a social media post on the Skinny McGinnies Facebook page on July 1st, the day that he learned he was infected with the coronavirus. He urged people who had contact with him to do the right thing and quarantine. "Get tested," his message said. "Sorry for the bad news." Rob asked Economopoulos about his condition that day. He responded, "Slight cough, but otherwise feel fine," Rob said. Economopoulos' condition rapidly worsened. He was admitted to Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital in Dubuque on July 6th and intubated and placed on a ventilator on July 11th. Larry was airlifted to UW-Madison for evaluation and treatment after Findlay Hospital had exhausted all options they could provide, Rob said. Rob said one potential life-supporting treatment is unavailable. Patients with severe and life-threatening respiratory illnesses, such as COVID-19, are sometimes treated with a life support machine called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, that replaces the function of the heart and lungs. Larry is not a candidate for the ECMO, as he's been on the ventilator too long and his lungs are too damaged, Rob said. Rob has known Economopoulos for 6 years, since Skinny McGinnies helped sponsor the local broadcaster's sports talk show on WDBQ AM. Rob helped create an online fundraising page for Economopoulos to help pay medical bills, utility bills, taxes for the bar, and other costs associated with the illness and the business being shuttered. Economopoulos closed the bar on June 29th when he fell ill, and it has been shut since. Rob said supporting Economopoulos now echoes the support the bar owner has provided to others for years. If anybody came to him for a donation or to host a fundraiser or publicize a benefit, he would do anything and everything he could, Rob said. There have been some fundraising events that he actually paid for airtime to promote. Economopoulos opened Skinny McGinnies in late 2013 at 123 Main Street. The bar relocated in 2018 to the first floor of 345 Main Street. Rob described Skinny McGinnies as providing a welcome atmosphere that was welcoming for anyone, anytime. Larry would often throw theme parties and special events, Rob said. Rob said Economopoulos formerly served as executive chef at Timmerman's Supper Club in East Dubuque, Illinois, and recently incorporated more of his cooking skills into the menu at Skinny McGinnies. Economopoulos' impact on the community is readily apparent in the hundreds of supportive comments on the Facebook post in which he first announced he had COVID-19 and subsequent updates. Larry means so much to so many, a result of always treating people with respect when they went to Skinny McGinnies and his generosity helping others, Rob said. Fenimore dairy farmers tap into niche milk market. A Grant County farm family has started to graze in a specialty market and sees lucrative pastures ahead. But the greatest challenge will be convincing dairy-shy shoppers that the family's line of milk and cheese is worth the extra cost. "We basically have a whole new customer base that has never enjoyed cheese or milk before," said Lonnie Holthouse, co-owner of Milkhouse Dairy in Fenimore. "That's the consumer base we're focusing on." Through selective breeding, the Holthouses are transitioning their herd of 400 cows to produce a special type of milk known as A2. Most milk and dairy products contain a protein known as A1 beta casein, but within the past 2 decades, producers have taken an interest in the A2 variety. The Holthouses believe that many of the 25% of U.S. residents who suffer from lactose intolerance actually are allergic to the A1 protein. Research suggests that such consumers might avoid the nasty gastrointestinal upset caused by dairy if they choose A2, but the evidence is inconclusive. Lonnie and Rochelle grew up milking cows in northeast Iowa. After relocating to Fenimore in the 1980s, they purchased a farm just outside of town in 2004. Their eldest son, Jeremy Holthouse, works at the operation full-time along with 10 employees. Several years ago, he noticed at livestock sales that bulls that carry the A2 trait rake in a premium, so he pitched the idea of entering the A2 market. "To make it today, you've got to have some kind of a niche," Jeremy said. Wisconsin lost more than 800 dairy farms in 2019, about 9% of the state's herd. With economic disruption continuing during the COVID-19 pandemic, the trend shows no sign of abating. "The dairy industry is in serious, serious trouble," Lonnie said. Generally, Brown Swiss, Guernsey, and Jersey cattle naturally carry the A2 trait, but larger Holsteins, which produce more milk, can be bred to do so. In 2016, the family began selecting for A2 dairy cows. It can take 1 or 2 generations to ensure successive offspring are born with the trait, which they verify after birth through genomic testing. The cows are pierced with blue ear tags to distinguish them from the rest of the herd. About 120 cows at the Holthouse's farm produce A2 milk, about 1,200 gallons daily, which is sent to 3 different companies for processing. For the customer, A2 milk comes at a cost. A half-gallon container often retails at twice the price of conventional milk, more than $4 in some supermarkets. But the expense is what makes farmers' investment worthwhile. Milk is one of those products that historically has been very difficult to differentiate, said Mark Stevenson, director of Center for Dairy Profitability at University of Wisconsin. You can only pretty much differentiate your product based on price. The rise in popularity of organic milk represents an industry success story, but low-carb milk did not fare as well, he said. Where A2 falls along the continuum remains to be seen. But like all new specialty products, additional costs are added throughout the production and distribution chain. To avoid commingling, the whole houses must segregate their A2 milk from A1, pumping the fluid into a separate storage tank and transporting it for processing in different milk trucks. If we have enough demand for a product like that, then I'm sure there'll be farmers that will happily try to segment their milk, Stevenson said. One of the world's largest distributors of A2 milk, the A2 Milk Company, which is based in New Zealand, has cultivated a following in the U.S. Since entering grocery stores in the mid-2000s, the company's products are in 17,500 stores across 160 retail and grocery chains, including Hy-Vee, Target, and Walmart. From July 1st to December 31st, 2019, the company's revenue in the U.S. more than doubled, up $28 million, compared to the corresponding period in 2018. Breaking into grocery chains poses a challenge for small producers such as Milk House Dairy, so the whole houses distribute their products in independent establishments in southwest Wisconsin, including Bender's Foods, Driftless Market, and Miller & Sons Supermarket. The family also sells products online. In March, they started producing a line of A2 cheeses, including cheddar, mozzarella, Munster, and Monterey Jack, and this month they began bottling their own milk. Lonnie said sales have been going gangbusters. Although enthusiasm for A2 milk appears to be shining, its health benefits are uncertain. I think the area is an interesting topic of research, said Tara Montgomery, associate professor of dairy and animal science at University of Wisconsin-Platteville. If we can do something in the industry to move that forward, I think that's a great idea. While a significant number of Americans are lactose intolerant, fewer are allergic to milk proteins. About 2% to 7% of children are affected, and the proportion decreases with age. Within 3 to 4 years, 80% develop a tolerance to milk protein, according to a study published in the Journal of Maternal, Fetal, and Neonatal Medicine. Studies funded by the A2 Milk Company found that milk containing A1 protein significantly increased signs of inflammation inside the guts of rats compared to A2 milk. A different study found that among people with lactose intolerance, A2 milk reduced some of the unpleasant symptoms associated with the condition, despite containing the same amount of lactose as conventional milk. Yet for many in the A2 dairy market, anecdotal reports of success are enough to keep them trying. It's amazing the comments from people. They are so thankful. They can eat cheese. They can have milk now, Rochelle said. You can help them enjoy it again. And from the almanac section today, with today being Tuesday, July 28th, it is the 210th day of 2020. There are 156 days left in the year. On this date in history, in 1794, Maximilien Robespierre, a leading figure of the French Revolution, was sent to the guillotine. In 1914, World War I began as Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. In 1929, Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis was born in Southampton, New York. In 1945, a U.S. Army bomber crashed into the 79th floor of New York's Empire State Building, killing 14 people. In 1959, in preparation for statehood, Hawaiians voted to send the first Chinese-American, Republican Hiram L. Fong, to the U.S. Senate and the first Japanese-American, Democrat Daniel K. Inouye, to the U.S. House of Representatives. In 1976, an earthquake devastated northern China, killing at least 242,000 people, according to an official estimate. And in 1984, the Los Angeles Summer Olympics opened. Now moving into the Dubuque and Tri-State section, County reports 15 additional virus cases in 24 hours. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Monday's developments included 15 more cases of COVID-19 were reported in Dubuque County between 5 p.m. Sunday and 5 p.m. Monday. The increase pushed the county's total to 1,362. There were 112 more tests from Dubuque County in that time frame, for a positivity rate of 13.4%. Dubuque County currently has one long-term care facility outbreak, Luther Manor, Grand Meadows, and Asbury has 3 residents who are positive for COVID-19, according to state information. As of Sunday, 21 people with COVID-19 in Dubuque County were hospitalized, an increase of 2 since the last state report on Friday. There appear to be 832 active cases in Dubuque County as of 5 p.m. Monday, an increase of 7 from one day prior. That number represents the number of COVID-19 deaths and recovered patients subtracted from the total number of cases. Jackson County reported 6 additional cases between 5 p.m. Sunday and 5 p.m. Monday, for a total of 126. Jones County reported 3 additional cases in that 24-hour period, bringing its total to 109. Clayton County reported 2 additional cases, so its total now stands at 81. Delaware County added 1 new case for a total of 79. Iowa's statewide total number of positive cases rose by 357 to 42,556. There were 6 additional deaths reported for a total of 833. Grant County, Wisconsin reported 6 additional cases Monday to bring the total to 297. Lafayette County reported 2 additional cases, totaling 102. Crawford County saw 1 additional case, bringing its total to 53. Iowa County had no additional cases Monday. Wisconsin reported another 590 new cases Monday, bringing its total to 49,417. There was 1 related death reported Monday, so that total is now 893. Joe Davies County total confirmed cases rose by 5 Monday to 101. Statewide, Illinois reported 1,231 additional cases Monday for a total of 172,655. There were 18 additional deaths for a total of 7,416. Heartland Financial reports 33% drop in quarterly net income. A Dubuque-based financial institution on Monday reported a 33% decline in net income in its second quarter. However, officials at Heartland Financial USA framed the 3-month stretch as a success given the unique challenges presented by COVID-19 and the company's efforts to aid business clients navigating the pandemic. President and CEO Bruce Lee said Heartland funded 4,800 Paycheck Protection Program loans totaling $1.2 billion in the quarter, preserving more than 112,000 jobs. "The pandemic situation continues to evolve, and our team has been dynamic, anticipating challenges and pivoting when necessary," said Lee. Midway through the fiscal year, Heartland is behind the pace of its 2019 performance. Heartland generated $30.1 million in net income during the quarter ending June 30th, down from $45.2 million during the same period last year. Through the first 6 months of the year, net income was $50.2 million, compared to the $76.7 million in the first half of 2019. Executive Operating Chairman Lynn Fuller still framed the recent quarter as a success, noting the unprecedented circumstances facing the financial institution. "During these very challenging times, our priority has been the safety of our employees and the ongoing support of our customers, our shareholders, and our communities," he said. Officials also said the income disparity between this year and the previous one is not as dramatic as it would appear. In the second quarter of 2019, Heartland's earnings were propped up by the sale of its mortgage servicing rights in multiple branches, with those deals collectively adding $18 million in net income. Meanwhile, COVID-19 has created a dynamic situation in which employees and customers are both contending with evolving circumstances. Employees who can carry out their duties from home are continuing to do so. Those coming into the bank locations have been placed on rotating teams to limit potential exposure. Heartland boasts a diverse geographic footprint consisting of 114 banking centers in the Midwest and Western U.S. The evolving nature of the novel coronavirus means that the company must apply different strategies in different markets. After closing most bank lobbies in March and April, Heartland began to reopen gradually on a state-by-state basis, but that plan was interrupted by the virus, Lee explained. "Recent outbreaks in some states have led us to pull back and close bank lobbies again in certain locations to protect the health and safety of our employees and customers," he said. "We recognize this will likely continue to occur across our footprint and our country. Despite these challenges, Heartland has continued to grow. Total assets were $15 million at the end of the second quarter, compared to $12.2 billion 1 year earlier. Dubuque County supervisors fill Board of Health vacancies. Dubuque County supervisors were updated on several facets of the county's COVID-19 circumstances during a lengthy meeting Monday night. The supervisors also filled 2 vacancies on the Dubuque County Board of Health. registered nurse and founder of Tri-State Area Medical Mass, Katie Jones, and Hillcrest Family Services health educator, Corey Young, will join the board, which has been front and center in the county's pandemic response. This will leave one vacancy on the board, created by Todd Lang's departure last week. The new members will take their seats effective Friday, August 1st, at the request of Board of Health Chairman Tom Betchen, according to County Supervisor Dave Becker. The Board of Health was unable to conduct business at its meeting last Wednesday because too many board members were absent. Quorum issues have been irregular issues with the Board of Health, said Supervisor Jay Wickham, who proposed again that the supervisors themselves join to alleviate them. It's going to be hard for them to act. The supervisors did agree to join with the Board of Health in pushing mask usage at events on county property and those sponsored by the county. The Dubuque County Board of Health strongly recommends that face masks be required at all times by anyone attending, participating in, or working at an event that takes place on any municipal or county-owned property, reads the board's recommendation. This recommendation also extends to all attendees, participants, and workers at municipal or county-sponsored events, regardless of where they occur. Supervisor Ann McDonough moved and received support for a proclamation to be prepared stating as such for county events, but removing the reference to municipal events, acknowledging the supervisor's lack of jurisdiction. And now some news in brief articles. Pedestrian injured when struck by vehicle in downtown Dubuque. A man was injured when he was struck by a vehicle while walking in a crosswalk Monday morning in downtown Dubuque. Richard J. Larson, age 63 of Dubuque, was taken by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment of his injuries, according to Dubuque Police. Police said Isaiah W. Boyd, age 21 of Dubuque, was traveling east on West 9th Street and was turning left onto Locust Street with a green light at 8:06 a.m. when his vehicle struck Larson, who was crossing West 9th in a marked crosswalk with a walk sign. Larson flipped over the car and landed in the street, according to the report. Larson suffered a cut around his left eye and complained about feeling dizzy and having left hip pain, police said. Boyd was cited with failure to yield to a pedestrian within an intersection and driving while barred. Local pharmacy chain requiring masks for customers. A local pharmacy chain now is requiring all customers and patients to wear face coverings in its retail locations. Hardig Drug Company announced a requirement effective Monday to help people protect themselves, our employees, the immunocompromised patients that must enter our pharmacy locations, and our local community. To be clear, we're not asking our store or employees to enforce this requirement, but are asking that our patients and customers protect themselves and those around them by following the majority of public health experts and Centers for Disease Control instruction to wear face coverings, said CEO Charlie Hartig in a press release. Hartig Drug has locations in Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin, including in Dubuque, Dyersville, Gutenberg, Monticello, and Preston, Iowa, Galena, Savannah, and Stockton, Illinois, in Darlington, Fenimore, Lancaster, Platteville, and Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Motorcyclist killed in Joe Davies County crash. A motorcyclist was killed in a crash Sunday morning in Galena. Jacob R. Thomas, age 50, of Iowa Falls, Iowa, died in the wreck, according to the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department. The crash occurred at about 5 a.m. Sunday on U.S. 20, about a quarter mile west of Oldenburg Lane. A press release states that Thomas was westbound when his motorcycle veered off the roadway and struck a tree. Local Wisconsin school districts eligible for CARES Act funding. 9 Southwest Wisconsin school districts are among 155 statewide that are eligible to apply for relief funding provided under the federal CARES Act. Districts were selected based upon COVID-19 impacts, which include factors such as economic disadvantage, access to personal computing devices, access to internet, and student scores on the English Language Arts Assessment, according to a press release. The following districts received funding: Belmont, $55,101.43, Boscobel, $112,087.90, Cassville, $29,580.77, Darlington, $123,543.20. Fenimore, $116,873.03. Iowa Grant, with $106,577.76. Lancaster, $142,103.68. Prairie du Chien, $167,914.35. River Ridge, $79,027.05. A total of $46.6 million in funding has been earmarked for Wisconsin school districts. Some Iowa 13 pavement work deemed non-compliant. A portion of the Iowa 13 road construction project has been deemed non-compliant. As a result, funds are being withheld from the contractor, and there is the possibility that some of the work will need to be redone, according to the project's engineering firm. According to a letter submitted by Fair Graham to the Manchester City Council, there currently is a change order for a decrease of $24,685.91 due to the non-compliant plain cement concrete placement along the south side of West Main Street. Fair Graham's Ryan Wicks said they will make the contractor redo any portion of the project that they don't feel has been completed to standards or satisfaction. According to the letter, Fair Graham held a meeting with contractor Perk Tobin and its subcontractor, Midwest Concrete, 2 weeks ago to discuss continued poor work and the need for better planning and compliance from Midwest moving forward. City to host Community Visioning Workshop Friday. Elkader will host a Design Day workshop from noon to 5:30 p.m. Friday, July 31st at Keystone Park. The workshop is part of Elkader's Community Visioning Program. A design team is working to develop a conceptual plan for Elkader, and the public can provide input at the workshop. Results from the focus group workshops and a random sample transportation survey also will be available. Library hosting watch parties. The East Dubuque Public Library is hosting online watch parties to provide entertainment amid the COVID-19 pandemic. East Dubuque District Library is showing movies on its Facebook page via the watch party function each Wednesday. The movies it already has shown include Princess Bride, Toy Story 4, 42, and Hunt for Red October. The upcoming movies to be featured are at 2 p.m. on July 29th, You've Got Mail, at 7 p.m. on August 5th, Ford vs. Ferrari, and 7 p.m. August 12th, The Martian, 7 p.m. August 19th, The King's Speech, and 7 p.m. August 26th, Legends of the Fall. Construction begins on hospital expansion. Following delays caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, construction on an $8.5 million 26,000-square-foot expansion at Southwest Health is underway in Platteville. In February, hospital officials made the announcement that the new addition will provide more space for existing services that have outgrown their quarters in light of increased regional demand for primary care, pharmacy, rehabilitation, specialty care, and orthopedics. The addition will be situated on the south side of the hospital and clinic campus. It is the latest major expansion project for the nonprofit health system, which formed in 1985. City seeks poll workers. Platteville officials seek poll workers for upcoming elections on Tuesdays, August 11th and November 3rd. The workers would replace people unable to serve due to age or health concerns related to the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the City of Platteville. Election inspectors are appointed at the municipal level in Wisconsin. Anyone interested in serving as a poll worker can call the city clerk's office at 608-348-1823. For more information, visit platteville.org/administration/page/elections. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Tuesday, July 28th, 2020. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Kenneth John McDermott, age 77, of Cascade, Iowa, passed away on Saturday, July 25th, at his home in Cascade, Iowa, surrounded by his family. Visitation for Kenneth will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, July 28th, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, Iowa. Social distancing will be followed, as recommended by federal and state guidelines. Face masks are required to attend the visitation. Anyone interested in sending memorials may send them to Rife Funeral Home, Attention Kenneth McDermott Family, at P.O. Box number 430, Cascade, Iowa 52033. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, Iowa, with Reverend Douglas Lackey presiding and Reverend Mark Osterhaus celebrating. For anyone unable to attend Mass, it will be live-streamed on the Rife Funeral Home Facebook page. Burial will be held in Calvary Cemetery in Cascade, Iowa, with full military honors afforded by the Cascade American Legion Post number 528. He was born April 8, 1943, in Cascade, Iowa, son of Raymond M. and Lenore R. McDermott. He was a graduate of St. Martin's High School in 1961 and attended college at the DeVry Technical Institute. In 1965, he volunteered as a lay missionary with Divine Word Missionaries in Papua New Guinea. This is where he met Maureen Trotter, his future wife of 52 years. On June 1, 1968, he was united in marriage to Maureen Trotter in Beechwood, New South Wales, Australia. Upon returning to Iowa, he fulfilled his draft obligation and spent 11 months in Vietnam. Kenneth and Maureen started their family business of McDermott Oil Company in 1972, which they operated for many years until their retirement. In his retirement years, he enjoyed wintering in Mesa, Arizona, where he could golf and relax with his friends and family. Kenneth was an avid golfer and sports fan, especially of the Boston Red Sox, Chicago Bears, Iowa Hawkeyes, and the Creighton Blue Jays. Kenneth was a veteran, having served in the Army during the Vietnam War. He was a member of St. Matthias Parish in Cascade, a member of the Cascade Knights of Columbus Council No. 930, and the Cascade American Legion Post No. 528. He was also a former member of the Cascade Volunteer Fire Department and past Cascade City Council member. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials for Kenneth be given to Aquin Elementary in Cascade or Divine Word Seminary in Epworth. View the video tribute or send online condolences to the family at www.reeffuneralhomeinc.com. The family would like to thank Bill and Kathy Gill for all their help and support and Hospice of Dubuque Home Instead, and the Mayo Clinic doctors in Minnesota and Arizona. Thank you to everyone for the well wishes, support, and prayers. Ralph L. Rowling, age 96, of 275 Princeton Place, died Saturday, July 25th at the Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m., followed by recitation of the rosary beginning at 7 p.m. on Thursday, July 30th at Hoffman Schneider Kitchen Funeral Home at 3860 Asbury Road. On behalf of Ralph's family, Mass will be required at the visitation and the Mass. Please respect our current social distancing requirements. If you are not feeling well or are unable to attend, we encourage you to visit www.hskfhcares.com to send a message to Ralph's family. The Mass of Christian Burial for Ralph will be at 10 a.m. Friday, July 31st at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church at 2001 St. Joseph Street, with Reverend Father Jim Gorin as the celebrant. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by the American Legion Post No. 6. The Mass will be live-streamed on Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home's Facebook page and will also be available to view later at www.hskfhcares.com. He was born July 24, 1924 in Dubuque, the son of Leo F. and Pearl C. Rowling, and was baptized August 3, 1924 at the Church of the Nativity by Reverend H.P. Rollman. He attended Nativity School, Loras Academy, and College, Northwest Missouri State University, and received his MBA from Harvard Business School. Ralph married Joan E. Saul on October 2, 1946, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church. After 57 years of marriage, Joan died on Christmas Eve, 2003. Ralph was in the U.S. Navy for 7 years and served as the supply and dispersing officer on a destroyer, the USS Hayward L. Edwards, in the Pacific Theater. He was with Weber Paper Company when it was founded in 1951, where he was a salesman, office manager, president, and chairman of the board. He retired in 1984 and remained as chairman of the board in the now Wepico Management and Consulting Company. He was a member of St. Joseph the Worker Parish and was past president of the parish council, member of the men's choir, and served in the first group of lay lectors and Eucharistic ministers. He and his wife organized the parish's first Christian family movement unit. He was a member of the Sierra Club, life member of the Council No. 510 Knights of Columbus, past president of the Downtown Kiwanis Club, Clark College Development Council, Dubuque Ambassadors, Squires Club, and past president of Dubuque Shooting Society 330 Club. Memorials may be given to St. Joseph the Worker Parish, Sierra Club, or Hills and Dales. Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in care of the arrangements. Condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Ralph's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Stephen A. Heffel, known as Steve, age 68, of North Buena Vista, Iowa, was called home suddenly at 12:25 a.m. on Friday, July 24th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. To celebrate Steve's life, private family services were held at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Burial will be in the Immaculate Conception Cemetery in North Buena Vista, Iowa. Steve was born on May 10, 1952, in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of Albert and Dorothy Heffel Jr. Steve attended grade school in North Buena Vista and went on to high school at Leah High School, West Dubuque High School, and finally graduated from Dubuque Senior High School. Steve was a jack of all trades and was employed with the railroad, B&K Meats and Cheryl, Dubuque Stamp, John Deere Dubuque Works, ran his own business called Heffel's Locker, FDL, Ohlner Tool and Die, and Riley Construction, before going back to John Deere, from where he would eventually retire in May of 2015. Steve met and eventually married his soulmate, Judy Plossel, on May 26, 1973, at St. Francis Church in Balltown, Iowa. They were blessed to settle down and raise their five boys and enjoy 47 years of wedded bliss together. In his free time, Steve enjoyed spending time in the great outdoors hunting, fishing, and riding and working on his motorcycle. He loved landscaping and was extremely proud of his yard, strategically placing every rock. Steve was an avid racing fan. He and Judy attended the Indy 500 every year for 30 years. He also liked watching westerns and always had a bowl of popcorn on his lap, as he was a true popcorn aficionado. Steve was also known for making his own homemade wine and brewing his own beer. Steve was a very simple man who required nothing but friends and could make a friend anywhere he went. We are deeply saddened at losing Steve so unexpectedly in our daily lives, and our nightly bowl of popcorn will never be the same without him. We miss you, love you, and look forward to the day we are all reunited again in heaven. Memorials will be accepted by the family and may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home at 1491 Main Street, Dubuque, Iowa, 52001, attention Steve Heffel family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com. James D. Law, age 68, of Dubuque, passed away on Sunday, July 19th, at home. Private services will be held at a later date. He is survived by his sister Joanne Law of Denver, Colorado, brother John C. Law, and children Jenna Yarborough of Aurora, Illinois, John Law of Pompano Beach, Florida, and stepson Bear DeMaya of Denver, Colorado. Jim has two grandsons, Wesley and Evander Yarborough, and three step-grandsons, Mason, Ryder, and Exan DeMaya. He was preceded in death by his parents, John and Peg Verla Law of Dubuque, Iowa, sister Kathleen Law of Madison, Wisconsin. Hazel L. Ellis, age 100, of Patch Grove and Prairie du Chien, died on Sunday, July 26th at Prairie Mason Nursing Home in Prairie du Chien. A graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, July 29th at Union Nagel Cemetery in Patch Grove. Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Prairie du Chien is assisting the family with arrangements. Mark F. Sonnenberg, age 71, of Dubuque and formerly of Spring Valley, Minnesota, passed away Sunday, July 26, from Alzheimer's disease. Private family services will be held. Mark was born on July 15, 1949, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the son of Charles and Leila Sonnenberg. He graduated from Columbia Heights High School in 1967 and furthered his education by receiving a master's degree in music from the University of Minnesota. Mark was a music instructor in Spring Valley, Minnesota for 34 years, retiring in 2006. On October 10, 2010, he married Jane Allman, and the two happily lived in Spring Valley, and in 2018 they moved to Dubuque. While attending the University of Minnesota, he had fond memories of performing in the marching band, and when living in Spring Valley, he played in the Rochester Symphony. Mark will be remembered for his pop concerts and his outdoor concerts in the backyard of his home in Spring Valley. He loved listening to classical music and wrote his thesis on the composer Gustav Mahler. Mark was a huge history buff, loved cats, and enjoyed bird watching, having the unique talent of bird calling several species. Mark's family would like to give a special thank you to the nurses and staff at Luther Manor for their unending care and compassion. The Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family. Carol Ann Smith, age 74, of Dubuque, died July 26th. Graveside service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Holy Family New Mallory Cemetery. All family and friends are encouraged to attend. Complete arrangements are pending with Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory at 2595 Rockdale Road. Richard Conrad, age 73, of Oroville, died on Sunday, July 26. Services are pending with Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Oroville. Kenneth G. Brown, known as Ken, age 85, of Dubuque, died on Sunday, July 26. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Friday, July 31st at Bear Funeral Home at 1491 Main Street. Funeral services will be held at 11:30 a.m. Friday at Sacred Heart Church at 2215 Windsor Avenue. Burial will be in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Betty J. Doze Frey, age 89, of Postville, died on Friday, July 24th at Good Samaritan Society in Postville. Graveside services will be held at 3 p.m. today at Wadena Cemetery. Shute Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Postville is assisting the family with arrangements. Keith Rothman, age 81, of Postville, died on Sunday, July 26th at Northgate Care Center in Waukon. There'll be a private graveside service. Shute Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Postville is assisting the family with arrangements. Denver C. Trom, Jr., age 87, of Mount Carroll, died on March 29th. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 8th at First Evangelical Lutheran Church in Mount Carroll, with a visitation prior to the service from 9 to 10 a.m. Daniel T. Welp, known as Dan, age 52, of East Dubuque, died on Sunday, July 26th. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, August 2nd, at Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque. A full obituary will be published on Friday, July 31st. Burial will be in the Nativity BVM Cemetery in Menominee. Donald Lewis Cornish, age 89, of Dubuque, passed away Saturday, July 25th, at Luther Manor. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 1st, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Visitation will be from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Crematory at 2659 Kennedy Road, where complete funeral arrangements are pending. And now we'll move over to some sports stories. The top headline in the sports section is WIAC officially cancels fall sports seasons. The Wisconsin Intercollegiate Athletic Conference announced Monday the cancellation of competition and championships for the fall sports seasons due to ongoing developments related to the coronavirus pandemic. In conjunction with the WIAC announcement, the UW-Platteville will not compete in conference or non-conference competitions for the 2020 fall season. "My heart goes out to all the student-athletes across the nation, not just in Wisconsin," said UW-Platteville Associate Athletic Director and Head Football Coach Mike Emmendorfer. "All sorts of teams from every different level are being affected by this, but the safety and well-being of the student-athletes and staff is the top priority when it comes to canceling sports. I've been a part of fall football for 40 years as a player and coach, and my heart goes out to them all. We sort of anticipated this, but when the news came out, it was just disappointing," he continued. "I understand the decision, absolutely. We're just disappointed these kids won't get the chance to compete in fall sports." The 8-team league also includes UW-Eau Claire, UW-La Crosse, UW-Oshkosh, UW-River Falls, UW-Stevens Point, UW-Stout, and UW-Whitewater. The Heart of America Athletic Conference, which contains Clark University, recently announced plans to move forward with its fall seasons, while the American Rivers Conference, which includes Loras College and University of Dubuque, is expected to announce its official decision this week. The announcement impacts seven UW-Platteville fall programs: men's and women's cross country, football, women's golf, men's and women's soccer, and women's volleyball. Of those sports, only women's golf will play the WIAC season and championship in the spring, while the rest have been completely canceled for the 2020 to 2021 academic year. "Things are moving pretty quickly since the news came out, and now we're looking at what can be done in the 114 practices or meetings that we can do through the year to get ready for 2021, said Emmendorfer, who completed his 21st season leading the football program last fall. "Our focus is always going to be on the person, the football player, and the student. So they know that we support them in their academics, making sure they're taking the right classes to graduate and getting excited to get back on the football field in 2021. According to a press release from the WIAC, institutions will retain the autonomy to establish practice opportunities within the limitations stipulated by the NCAA throughout the 2020-21 academic year. Any practice opportunities or competitions must be conducted in accordance with NCAA resocialization guidelines in effect at that time, in addition to any mandated restrictions imposed by local, county, or campus entities. Our staff will continue to enhance the student-athlete experience during each student-athlete's academic term at UW-Platteville, said UW-Platteville Director of Athletics Christine Navarro in a release statement. Each team's coaching staff is working diligently to plan the fall practice schedule, and head coaches will be reaching out to student-athletes in the near future to convey report dates and fall plans. I want to reassure our student-athletes, parents, and supporters that Chancellor Dennis Shields and I are committed to the long-term success of Pioneer Athletics, and we will continue to invest in the development of our current student-athletes during challenging times, all while keeping the safety and well-being of the entire UW-Platteville community in the forefront. We will also continue to invest in the personal and professional development of our staff and coaches. Determinations regarding the WIAC winter sports seasons, including the start date and the manner in which competition will be conducted, will be determined at a later date, according to the release. But with the current state of COVID-19, cases moving in the wrong direction, even that is hard to predict. Winter sports will be the next objective, Emmendorfer said. None of us predicted the spike in numbers. We thought they'd level off and go down. But it increased in July. That worried a lot of us. With winter sports, if they can play, we need that. When we can get back to the point of having people in the stands enjoying athletics, that's where you'll really see the appreciation for what sports can do for everyone involved. And from prep softball, Hawks rally falls short. For six frustrating innings, West Delaware just couldn't find a hit. Finally, with two outs in the bottom of the seventh, they finally started falling. Then, with the tying run on deck, the game and the Hawks season suddenly ended on a foul bat. Kayla Felton's foul ball was the final play of the game as an umpire ruled the base runner left first base prior to the pitch, sealing 7th-seeded Winterset's 7-4 victory over number 2 West Delaware in an Iowa Class 4A state quarterfinal on Monday at Rogers Sports Complex. Winterset, with a record of 15-7, advanced to Thursday state semifinal against 6th-seeded Dallas Center Grimes with a record of 20-9. West Delaware ended the season 21-5. We're really, really sad that it ended this way, but we're still really grateful that we were able to come here and be able to play, compared to other schools that weren't able to participate this year, said West Delaware left fielder Alyssa Holt, who collected 3 of the Hawks' 7 hits. Trailing 7-1, Eve Wedewer opened the 7th with a double to left field before Winterset starter Thea Banning struck out the next 2 batters. Leah Wegman drove an RBI single to left, and Holtz beat out an infield hit. The runners moved to 2nd and 3rd on a pass ball, setting up Mia Payton's 2-run single to the gap in left center. With pinch runner Lexi Hartman on first and leading hitter Macy Kleisch representing the tying run in the on-deck circle, Felton fouled off the first pitch she saw. The Winterset players soon began cheering as they realized what had happened. "I thought it was called on me. I thought I threw something illegal," Banning said. Instead, the game was over. "It's tough, but I think you've got to look at the big picture," West Delaware coach Tiffany Rave said. "In any ball game you play, whether it's softball or anything else, one play does not decide a game. We had a lot of opportunities. We had 7 innings worth and 21 outs to work with. Unfortunately, one out didn't go our way, and that's just the way it is." It certainly didn't look like it would be a close game after the Huskies pounded out 11 hits and 7 runs in the first 3 innings. Winterset scored 5 runs in the 2nd inning, with Ava Loudon's 2-run homer putting the Huskies ahead 6-0. "All of us had our doubts, but we all picked our heads up and were like, we've got to show what Hawk softball really is," Holt said. "Getting those runs in the last inning really made us feel better about ourselves and what our team was about." West Delaware got 1 run back in the bottom of the 2nd as Wegman, the Hawks catcher, worked a 2-out walk. Courtesy runner Olivia Schulte stole 2nd and scored on Holtz's single. But Banning limited West Delaware after that. Until the 7th, the Hawks managed just 2 more base runners, 1 in the 4th and 1 in the 5th. "They hit the ball in spots and we kind of hit it right to people," said Kleisch, who allowed 13 hits with 2 walks, 1 intentional and 2 strikeouts. "I thought we were prepared for the game. We just couldn't get any momentum on our side. No matter how it was going through, we were giving our full effort and things just didn't turn out like we'd like to. But we played our hearts out and I'm just proud of that." And now from prep baseball, commitment to team. Devin Udaly envied some of his buddies on the Western Dubuque baseball team as he watched them participate in the state tournament the past 2 summers. So he didn't mind a little extra sacrifice if it meant he could make it there himself during his senior year at Dubuque Hempstead. The Mustangs earned the number 3 seed and will take a 15-1 record into Wednesday's quarterfinal against Iowa City High with a record of 11-8 at Principal Park, the home of the Chicago Cubs AAA affiliate. The semifinals are set for Friday, and the championship game will take place Saturday. When you step into the batter's box at Principal Park, you can see the state capitol in the background. The field is just amazing, and it's about the coolest environment you can have for playing high school baseball, said Yule, the Mustangs' leading hitter with a .474 average. After seeing my friends play down there, it's almost like a dream come true to know I'll be playing there too. Now, it's my turn. This season, making it to the state tournament required so much more than just a commitment to the game. The coronavirus pandemic wiped out most spring workout programs, and many believed there wouldn't even be a season until the Iowa High School Athletic Association gave it the green light in late May, right around the time teams should have been making final preparations for opening day. Practice started roughly a month later than usual. Teams had only 2 weeks together before beginning games on June 15th, and most teams struggled to play 20 games when they've become accustomed to playing a schedule with 30 to 40. On top of that, players, coaches, and spectators received strict protocol to prevent exposure to the virus. That included daily set temperature checks, gallons of hand sanitizer, plenty of social distancing, and wearing facial protection in certain situations. We knew from the beginning that we had a pretty special team with the potential to make it to the state tournament, so we kept our circle as tight as possible and we did everything we could to follow the protocol, senior second baseman Max Pinn said. We were focused on playing baseball, and we had one goal in mind, winning a state championship. By keeping our circle tight, we ended up doing a lot more things together as a team away from the field, so there was a lot of team bonding. It paid off, and now we have a great opportunity to play at Principal Park and prove to everybody that we belong down there. In addition to following the protocol when the team practiced, played games, and took bus trips together, Hempstead coach Jeff Rapp constantly reminded his players to be safe away from the ballpark. That often meant staying away from an annual rite of passage, the graduation party circuit, as well as other social gatherings outside of the baseball circle. It was certainly a challenge for everybody, but I give our guys a lot of credit for being vigilant about social distancing and following all the protocols, Rapp said. We took all the precautions that were necessary when we were together, but it's awful hard to control what happens outside the ballpark. If you go out in public, it's almost like you're playing Russian roulette with this virus. More than anything, I think we got lucky with this thing. If you look across schools like Wallert and West Des Moines and Senior, and WD and Senior, they all followed the protocol too, but it hit them. You just hope that it doesn't get you too. Wallert and Western Dubuque saw their seasons interrupted by positive COVID-19 tests within the program, but both returned in time for the postseason. Senior learned of a positive test less than a week before its sub-state tournament opener and forfeited because it couldn't complete a quarantine in time. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Tuesday, July 28, 2020. I'm your reader, Christy Frieders. You can access the recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.